Hello, good morning. It's great to be back at Brigham Young University. Wonderful place, so inspiring, surrounded by majestic mountains, and it's wonderful to be here with all my learned friends, new and some that I made when I was here 3 years ago. I hope you can all hear me. My topic today is a bit of an introduction of the religious trends and challenges and practices in Australia, and I hope that it will be enlightening. Australian society has never been more religiously diverse. There are five major religions represented by a population of 22,662,492 in the last census, 2006. Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism are named in the official statistics, followed by other religions and no religion. The latter category is growing, and this year a number of anti-religion groups have banded together to campaign on billboards and buses across the country to encourage people to vote no religion in this year's census, that is, to describe themselves as belonging to the no religion category. This census just took place in August. The results have not yet been published. This unprecedented action signifies the strengthening of a coalition of anti-religion groups in the Australian population who've hosted well-publicized major conferences featuring international speakers like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Michael Shermer, Peter Singer. The freedom to be irreligious is normally not an issue in Australia, since no one is disenfranchised for non-belief. However, this sector of society is not satisfied with merely increasing its numbers. It wishes to challenge the presence of religion in places which they believe should be religion-free zones. For example, they've banded together to support Ron Williams' 2009 case against the Commonwealth of Australia, in which he opposed the federal government's funding of the National School Chaplaincy Program, the NSCP, arguing that it's unconstitutional. In 2010, the Federal Budget of Australia announced that $222 million had been provided to the NSCP funding which has been endorsed by both sides of Parliament. The outcome of Williams' case, which was listed for a full hearing on the 9th, 10th, and 11th of August this year, was to actually increase the funding for chaplaincy in schools, but to include social workers as religious chaplains. This is one case of religious freedom in Australia being challenged by the growing body of outspoken religion critics who want to see the public square an entirely free zone, a religion-free zone. They essentially want to ban religion from any government-funded setting. The same groups have also agitated for the removal of the Lord's Prayer before the sitting of Parliament, and most recently, the Edgewater Primary School in Perth in Western Australia was successful in removing the Lord's Prayer from the fortnightly assembly, citing that it was against the state's Education Act. The absolute separation of church and state, which this sector wishes to enforce, actually runs counter to the historical support that successive Australian governments have given to Christian and other religious schools, having allocated them funds in education budgets. This is a continuing source of grievance by public school stalwarts, not only on ideological grounds, but also on financial grounds, alleging that private schools are privileged, do not need the money, while public schools are in need and left to languish. While there certainly are privileged private schools, it's also true that in Australia, there are a great many religious schools that are not affluent, especially in the Catholic school system. Across the board support given to religious schools has been one way the Australian government has sought to generate a fair and multi-religious society. Most of the beneficiaries of this would say it is working well. However, concern has also been expressed that some of the schools are not up to scratch. When everyone was talking about evolution a few years ago, the concern was expressed about small private schools, that Christian private schools, that taught creationism and creation science. Today, with the proliferation of Muslim schools established with seed money from Saudi Arabia and other Arab states, concern is expressed about the influence their patrons have on the ethos of the school. The inculcation of severe dress codes, for example, which see young prepubescent girls wearing the hijab, a garment that is normally only required for young women, is indicative of a trend among Muslim schools. The same, however, could also be said of the Hasidic ultra-Orthodox Jewish schools, which also encourage strong boundaries of separation between them and the rest of society. Dress codes are a flashpoint right now in Australia, a country that ironically is very relaxed about dress. The growing conservatism of young Muslims, a trend experienced in Australia as much as elsewhere, is generating conflict on both sides of the equation. Australia is the land of the fair go, and on the whole, it has not seen many public stoushes around matters of dress, but when they do happen, they have been very serious. The wearing of the hijab, for example, has not raised the ire of people in general, whereas the wearing of the burqa has. Last year, a Muslim woman in Western Australia, for example, refused to remove her burqa in a court of law to give evidence in a criminal case. After much wrangling, the court did force her to comply in a private hearing. Recently, another woman who was stopped by the routine highway patrol for speeding refused to remove her facial covering and then falsely accused the policeman of racism. As the whole encounter was captured on video, her accusation was not sustained by the evidence. The judge, however, decided to throw out the case on the grounds that he could not be sure that the woman was the right woman, given that she was not able to be identified. This Wisdom of Solomon ruling forced the issue of identification, which is key in any court case. It led to the State of New South Wales government ruling that burqas would have to be removed for police to make a proper identification. It also prompted one New South Wales parliamentarian, Fred Nile, to call for a ban of the burqa based on security reasons primarily, which to date has not received parliamentary support. Yet Australians do have concerns about Islam as it relates to the country's security. Australia has had its fair share of wannabe suicide and bombers and terrorists who have joined forces overseas, such as the convert David Hicks, who spent time in Guantanamo Bay prison before being extradited to serve his time in Australia. We've had wannabe terrorists, such as the Algerian cleric Abdul Nasser Ben Brika, the convicted spiritual leader of a group of men who drew up plans, wrote manuals, and amassed explosives with the intention of blowing up sensitive Australian sites, such as Lucas Heights, the home of the Australian Atomic Energy Commission, which houses two nuclear reactors. Recently stated targets for terrorist attack included the Sydney Opera House, the iconic heart of Australia's premier city. And being so close to Indonesia, the home of the terrorist organization Jamaah Islamiyah, who perpetrated the Bali bombing on October 12, 2002, which left 202 people dead, 88 of them Australians, and also with the presence of Indonesian people smugglers enabling weekly boatloads of illegal Muslim migrants to Australian shores, these do have a cumulative effect of concern, not only about where the next bomb will come from, but about the loss of control over the sovereign laws of the nation concerning immigration. The prominence of Islam in the current media coverage about religious freedom has another dimension as well. How much does Islam restrict religious freedom? Government-funded religious pluralism through multicultural bodies at the state and federal level now celebrates practices that were once considered oppressive to women, and Australians fought hard to overturn. Thus, women who are living under particularly extreme Wahhabist form of Islam, imported from places like Somalia or Saudi Arabia, are not expected to embrace Western norms and are rarely subject to critique in what has become an ultra-sensitive environment. Muslim women reformers in Australia are virtually non-existent. I can't name any. However, there are visiting Muslim women reformers who come occasionally, but they are usually the guests of non-Muslim conferences. A PhD student at the University of Western Australia, Carol Kaplanian, is examining the extent of family practices in Muslim communities which violate Australian laws. These include female genital mutilation, underage marriage, kidnapping, polygamy, and honour crimes in Australia. She is also acting as a liaison to the Western Australian Police Force. In an interview with me on the Spirit of Things, she told me that these practices are profoundly cultural and are not solved simply by recourse to the law. It will only be changed through re-education. Sharia law is, of course, the constant subject under discussion, and multitudes of press articles have been written on it, usually prompted by incidents such as the reported case of a Muslim convert who was held down and whipped 40 times by four men for being caught drinking. The police commissioner of New South Wales, Andrew Scipione, commented, quote, "When it comes to Sharia, I've said it before and I'll say it again. There's no place in Australia for Sharia law, full stop." But Sharia law is already being practiced in Australia. An article in the upcoming issue of the University of New South Wales Law Journal reports that because Sharia has long operated in the unofficial realm, quote, "the wider Australian community has been oblivious to the legal pluralism that abounds in this country." This is particularly so in relation to polygamy. The spokesman for the Sydney Lebanese Muslim community, Kaiser Trad, advocated polygamy in a public talk at the Opera House. Jamila Hussein, a lecturer in Islamic law at the University of Technology, said, quote, "Some people just have a religious marriage rather than having a secular marriage. And the only way they can undo it is by going to a religious authority." This, of course, has other implications. Divorce is easily initiated by the man, and this would not necessarily grant custody of the children to the mother, since Islam grants custody to the father at a predetermined age. So far, I've mentioned secular challenges to religious freedom and religious practices that conflict with freedoms guaranteed by Australia's common law. Now, I'll mention what happens when religious views bump up against the law. Australia has racial vilification legislation in place at the federal level, and it was used successfully in the case of Frederick Tobin, a South Australian who used the internet to promote racial hatred against Jews. After pursuing him legally for 10 years, Jeremy Jones, on behalf of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, was successful in having Tobin prosecuted for his website, which denied the Holocaust and vilified the Jewish people. He was found to be in breach of the Racial Discrimination Act. The state of Victoria has the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act 2001, which makes it unlawful to incite or encourage hatred against a person or a group of people based on their race or religion. The act was used by the Islamic Council of Victoria against Catch the Fire Ministry, alleging that the latter held seminars which vilified Islam. The seminars in question were three lectures given by Daniel Scott and on the issue of jihad. Initially convicted of vilifying Islam, Scott and Danny Nalia, the founder of Catch the Fire Ministry, appealed. And on the 14th of December 2006, the Supreme Court of Victoria upheld the appeal and ordered that the matter be re-decided without hearing new evidence by a judge of the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. The Islamic Council of Victoria was ordered to pay half of Scott's and Nalia's legal costs of the appeal. The Act is still in force, but it's claimed that it doesn't actually improve relations between groups, but exacerbates them, encouraging division rather than an open exchange of ideas. Regardless of remedies which may be sought after the fact, the experience of religious persecution cannot be wholly prevented. Among the small Jewish community in Australia, which numbers about 100,000, which is half of 1%, there is a growing unease. Jewish businesses are targeted for destruction, graffiti, and protests. Orthodox Jews have been attacked on the street because of their obvious different appearance. And on campus, Jewish students have also been harassed, bullied, and attacked. Synagogues and schools across Australia are heavily guarded, and no Jewish event takes place, from visiting speakers to the weekly Sabbath services, without the presence of security men and women who are volunteers from the community. Ostensibly, attacks usually go under the banner of anti-Israel actions, but they have gone far beyond a political protest. Indeed, the anti-Israel obsession is so far out of proportion to the actual situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories, and so far in excess of the situations taking place elsewhere around the world, such as in Africa and in Muslim countries, that the targeting of Jews is transparently a case of religious persecution. Such activity includes Sydney University Muslim Students Association distributing extremely anti-Semitic material in their orientation day packets, and another organization making mail drops in suburbs of equally extreme anti-Semitic material of the kind that was produced by the Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels. This occurs despite the involvement of high-level members of the Jewish community in interfaith organizations, events, and programs. Together for Humanity, a leading interfaith organization that brings members of different faiths to schools and small towns across the country for workshops on religious understanding and tolerance, is headed by a young Hasidic Jewish rabbi who is passionate about working together with other faiths, especially Muslims. Together for Humanity was founded with a generous donation from the late Stella Cornelius, a Jewish woman who lost many of her family in the Holocaust. Today, the red button issue of religious freedom is Islam. There's no doubt about it. But not so many years ago, the main focus was on the challenge that a host of cults and sects presented and posed to the Western way of life and rule of law. Yet cults continue to challenge the laws of our country, except for ex-members and support groups such as the Cult Information and Family Services, which is open, which is about to have a briefing conference in our nation's capital shortly. Few people know about it. Scientology is the exception. It's been in the news recently with one of our independent senators from South Australia, Nick Xenophon, hoping to challenge its status as a religion and thereby remove its tax privilege status. This has proved very unpopular, as parliamentarians are loath to restrict religious activity, given the protection of religion detailed in Section 116 of our Constitution. Even when all the evidence points to Scientology operating as a business, there is little will to remove the status of religion it achieved in 1973. A final report of the Fair Work Ombudsman found Scientology treated employees as if they were as if they were volunteers and paid them $10 a week, and found it potentially breached the laws relating to slavery. Religious freedom is very much alive in Australia, despite the scandalous number of sexual abuse cases that has been a consistent feature of the last 10 to 15 years of religious news coverage. This has been nowhere more evident than in the Catholic Church, but it is certainly not limited to it. Apart from the immeasurable human cost, the monetary cost continues to build, and the Maitland-Newcastle Catholic Diocese recently paid $13 million in compensation to the victims of two child sex abusers. There has been no government call to lift the ban of secrecy of the confessional, as has been proposed by the Irish government. However, as of mid-August this year, the Attorney General of the State of Victoria is considering whether an investigation into sexual abuse in the Catholic Church of Victoria is warranted in relation to the extensive abuses discovered in the Diocese of Ballarat. Generally speaking, the issue of religious freedom in Australia comes to light in a case-by-case manner, as there is no widespread sense among religious groupings that they are under threat. No organization speaks on behalf of religious freedom, since alienation, if not suspicion, among Australia's religious communities prevents them from banding together. Besides, each religious community has different battles to fight. If anything, the September 11 anniversary this year demonstrated how far the Muslim population in Australia promoted itself in the general population through community events. There is one community that I have not mentioned, the over 500,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. The issue of religious freedom is a vexed one, given the controversial use of customary law, which has been sanctioned in some cases in the Northern Territory by the Northern Territory government. While Torres Strait Islanders are generally Christian and would not employ customary law as a rule, Aboriginal Australians, especially in the townships and remote communities, do. Yet, even they are divided on whether this law is desirable, given its brutal nature based on the principle of payback. There are also customary practices which endanger children and women, which Aboriginal leaders like the full-blood Walpiri woman Bess Nungiari Price have campaigned against. When it comes to such practices as sanctioned by notions of religious freedom, she would be the first to want to restrict such freedoms. And she is a supporter of the government's intervention in other ways, such as the limiting of alcohol, the linking of welfare payments to the education of children, etc. Fundamentally, the issue of religious freedom can never be approached as an unlimited value, so long as religions inculcate attitudes and practices that conflict with the cherished values of our free society, such as equality between men and women, the rights of children, freedom of conscience, movement, and association, harmony between groups, and most especially, the rule of law. Thank you.